Welcome to the Special Ed Strategist Podcast, where we strategize all things special ed. I am excited to have this conversation with you guys, to listen and seriously grab paper, some pens, coffee, whatever you need, sit back and get ready to absorb this information, coming together and collaborating, cooperating, compromising to come and find a beautiful consensus to better support the children that we serve. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. I am my mom and special educator. I have sat at both sides of that IEP table as a parent and a professional. And over the last 25 plus years, I have made it my passion and mission to help parents and professionals bridge learning gaps, access special education services, and build kick butt IEPs. If you want more tips, show us some love on social at Learning Essentials. If you are new to our podcast, give us a download, a follow, a like, or a share. Let's get ready to strategize special education style. Welcome to the show. I'm excited that you are both able to take time out of your busy schedule and talk with us and shed some light on better supporting our students and talking about, is this autism? And so welcome. And I'd love for both of you to introduce yourselves and give us a little bit of brief background of how you got to strategizing and supporting students.
So my name is Sarah Wayland. I am a special needs care navigator, certified RDI consultant, and parenting coach. I have a PhD in cognitive psychology and did research for a number of years. And then because of my own children, got very interested in neurodivergence and realized that if it was as hard to navigate things for them with my background, I could help other parents navigate without making all the mistakes I made. So that's how I got to where I am. And I'll let Donna explain how she and I became part of the same project.
Oh, yeah, that's a good story. So it's funny, you said that your family helped you sort of get to where you are professionally. I think mine is the opposite. I became a licensed psychologist. I've been one for over 30 years and was doing neuropsychological evaluations for children who have all kinds of learning differences, ADHD, other things, including autism, and gradually realized, wait a minute, I have a neurodiverse family. And so my professional life taught me about my home life. And however you come to it, I think they just end up blending together and you learn from both, right? Sarah and I have known each other professionally and personally for years. And I had an idea for a book to help people recognize the less obvious presentations of autism, and knew I needed a co-author because of my own ADHD, and spent about a year sort of looking at everybody in my life, wondering, like that old P.D. Eastman book, are you my mother? Are you my co-author? Are you my co-author? And one day it became so clear. Yes, yeah, Sarah's holding up the book now. Are you my co-author? Sarah Wayland is my co-author.
I love that. What a great story. And it is very true. I feel like in the world of special education and neurodivergence, roads lead us here for a reason. And so let's hop in. Can you first define autism through your professional scope?
Sure. I can take that one. I think that being autistic at its core means having a different kind of nervous system than most people have. And if you have this different kind of nervous system, you're going to experience and process and respond to the world differently from non-autistic people in a lot of ways. And this can include differences in your experience of external sensations like noises and textures, your experience of internal sensations like hunger or pain, your movement patterns, your communication, and your information processing. And that's sort of the core of autism, but then there are layers on top of that, because having a different kind of nervous system is not a problem in and of itself, except that autistic people have to live in a world that is really designed largely by and for non-autistic people. And so it can be incredibly stressful for them. And there's this mismatch between their nervous system and the world, which leads to overwhelm, it leads to misunderstandings and being misunderstood, it leads to social problems and anxiety. And so it's complex.
It is complex. And I think that's the importance of your book that's coming out, and we're going to talk about that as well. And just for parents and professionals to really understand that. And I love how you worded it as using the nervous system. And I think that really gives people this scope of kind of where students may be coming from. Can you share with our listeners what you see as strengths of autism?
Sure. Strengths of autism. So one of the chapters we wrote in our book, it was very important to us to not just address, you know, sort of the diagnostic criteria, but we also wanted to help people understand that being autistic means there are certain things you do incredibly well. And so some of the things we noticed were, for example, those sensory differences that Donna was talking about. You know, they can be a weakness if you're like in a, you know, you're sensitive to sound and you're in an overwhelming environment like a cafeteria or a concert or something like that. But it can also be a gift. So, for example, you know, audio engineering or musicians, like being very sensitive to sound means that you can hear and process sound in a way that other people may not be sensitive to. You might notice visual details that other people miss. Or you might be good at diagnosing a mechanical problem, like by listening to a motor and hearing that it's running differently, for example. You know, having an incredible sense of smell can help you detect a gas leak. Or, you know, also like people work in the perfume industry or, you know, and then taste, you know, so being an incredible chef, right? Like you can taste things and know which flavors will go together and which won't. You know, touch, just feeling the texture of things. So, you know, being working in textiles or woodworking to know what the you know, what it feels like. And likewise, you know, proprioception, which is just your body's, you know, your sense of your body and how it's positioned and all those things. If, you know, you're undersensitive to that, you could wear clothing that other people wouldn't tolerate and look awesome in them. Or you could be really good at certain athletic things because you know exactly how to move your body. So, you know, these are all sensory differences that in the right context can be incredible strengths. There's also ways of thinking that can be, and by the way, these are individual differences. So not every autistic person is going to have this, right? These are just things to look for in the person, you know, that's in front of you. But, you know, in terms of thinking, there's an increased attention to and memory for very detailed information. So it's common to have autistic people who have memorized a train schedule or, you know, really know all these incredible baseball statistics, for example, or, you know, a comprehensive knowledge of history, things like that. They're very good at making associations between things. Some people very good at making associations and seeing patterns that other people might not notice. And that pattern finding ability is something we see in a lot of autistic people. And it can be a real strength if you're trying to figure out, is something going wrong here? Or what is the pattern to this? You know, a narrow and intense focus of attention allows you to deep dive on something you're learning about. And so you can develop this incredible comprehensive knowledge of a topic, which means you can be a real expert at something. And because you have that ability to focus and pay attention for a long time, that can be really a problem in the classroom when you're required to, you know, shift constantly between things. But if you are, you know, studying at your desk and you are really interested in the history of the Vietnam War, then you're going to dive into that and be able to you know everything you want to know about it. So there's another concept called systemizing, and that's really that pattern recognition I mentioned, but also just putting things in, I guess cataloging is what I'll call it, but figuring out the structure and order to things when maybe other people don't see a structure and order to things, and just logically reasoning through problems. So scientists and engineers, you know, they need to be very logical and comprehensive and thorough. So, you know, that particular skill can be useful in that context. And, you know, these intense interests, which both define it as, you know, part of the diagnostic criteria, but it means you could be an amazing expert And another thing, like some autistic people are really good at organizing things and being super consistent about something. So if you, you know, a job that some autistic people really love having are like, you know, straightening up grocery store shelves, right? Because they're very good at making them organized and neat and looking good. And, you know, and they might show up to work at the, you know, exactly right time every single day. So, you know, that consistency in some jobs is super helpful. The last few things that we found that I find interesting. So because of the social communication challenges that some autistic people are navigating, then they actually have their own style. They're often very straightforward and honest about what they see. So if you want the straight scoop on what's going on, ask an autistic person because they're going to give it to you. And I think Greta Thunberg is a good example of that. She just calls it like she sees it. And I love her for it. You know, a strong sense of integrity. So, you know, fighting for things that they think are important, social justice causes, you know, just calling out when you see something wrong happening and really fighting for it. And, you know, that's, we need people like that in the world. Less susceptible to peer pressure. So, you know, if everybody else is jumping off a cliff, they'd be like, I'm not sure I want to jump off that cliff. And so, like, as a parent, I never had to worry that my kids were going to be doing that. That's awesome. Accepting of differences because they have spent their lives being different, being rejected for those differences. They're very sensitive, can be very sensitive to others. And the fact that if somebody is different, that doesn't make them somehow less than, it just means they're different. And just very, this one is often misunderstood, very keenly attuned to the emotions of other people. So tuned into the emotional valence in the room. And a lot of people will say, well, my child can't be autistic because she's so sensitive to, you know, the emotions going on. And we like to talk about the difference between affective empathy, so that sensitivity to the affect in the room, versus cognitive empathy, understanding why someone's upset. So, you know, but knowing that someone's upset is the first step to figuring out that someone's upset and you need to figure out why. Another one is a sense of humor. So a lot of autistic people love wordplay. So puns and just silly word games, and also very irreverent. So, you know, and so comedians, you know, there are a number of comedians who are autistic and identify as such. So, you know, that's I think it's a real gift and people don't recognize that. And the most important one is resilience and grit. These people have had to navigate a world not built for them, and they show up every day anyway. It's a huge deal.
Wow. Wow. You got me a little emotional over here. So you did an excellent job of painting these strengths. How do we as parents and even professionals or educators help support our children, right? Because you gave some awesome ideas in terms of what you could be in the world in terms of careers and future thinking as adults. How do we nurture this when they're young to kind of help relieve some of that pain that, you know, trying to align in a world that's not built for them?
So I'm going to start with parents. So what parents can do. So the first thing is to make sure your kid has time to do what they love and enjoy every day. So one thing that happened to me, frankly, as a parent, is I was so focused on making sure that my kids were getting the help they needed for the things that were hard for them, that initially I forgot that they have interests and passions and they're amazing. And I needed to make sure they had time to do that. So I hired a science tutor for my older son who came every Saturday and they just did science and engineering kinds of experiments every weekend. And he looked forward to that a lot. So, you know, just making sure your kids have time to do what they love and enjoy. You know, something I used to do and still do actually with my kids is I brag about my kids behind their back. Like if they're in the other room, I'll say to my husband, oh, you know what my kid did today? You know, guess what? And so they can hear me talking about it, but it's not direct praise. That's one of my favorites. So no, and this gets to noticing what they are doing well. So really make sure you're focusing your attention on what's going well for them, what they're doing right. Acknowledge it. It's important to customize that because some kids don't want you to like directly praise them or have big effusive, wow, you're amazing. Like, so, you know, just make sure that you know how your kid likes to get praise and, you know, expose them to things also that you think they might enjoy. So kids only know what they know. So you want to try to expose them to lots of things. There's a story about my older son who loves music. And I thought, oh, he loves music. So what do? I take him to an orchestra concert where they're performing Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. Not a good plan. He was under a chair the whole time. And we finally had to go out into the lobby because A, it was too loud, but B, like the music was so unfamiliar. And then like a month later, my husband took him to the Gamer Symphony Orchestra at University of Maryland and he had a blast. And so you have to think about how you're doing the exposure, but you know, just think about, you know, how can they learn about things that are fun for them. With teachers, what you want to do is think of ways to incorporate strengths, that child's strengths into the lessons so the child can demonstrate their expertise. And I also think it's really important. I mean, when you heard me talking about the strengths there, I was talking about some things that are hard, but in the right context, they're actually a gift. So reframing your thinking, and instead of focusing on a negative interpretation of something like this kid's always correcting me, right? You can reframe that as he has a strong sense of integrity and wants to make sure it's right, right? So reframing how you think about what's going on there can be very helpful. And in front of the other kids in the classroom, notice what's great about this kid, you know? So when he does something really amazing and notices something that other people aren't noticing, you can say, wow, your attention to detail is incredible. So the other kids hear, oh, this kid has a strength that's important. And make sure you give them an opportunity to deep dive on topics that they enjoy, just like I said for parents, and using their interests to help them learn things they might not otherwise care about. An example of that is Temple Grandin talked about a third grade teacher who wanted them to learn about poetry, which he really didn't care about. So the teacher went and found a bunch of poems on doors and just, you know, gave her all these poems about doors, and Temple Grandin loved doors. And so she was able to learn about poetry through her interest in doors. You know, that's really important. Also, like showing them that they can be leaders and they can be helpful. So for example, having them help a younger child at recess or something like that. And when they self-advocate, make sure you respond. Don't just say, oh, that's ridiculous. You shouldn't, you know, need to go take a break right now. Or, you know, don't, you know, dismiss their attempts at self-advocacy. Very often we think kids are trying to get out of something when in fact, what they're trying to do is self-regulate. So allow them to self-advocate.
Donna, can I ask you, so can you convey, so we kind of talked about what parents could do, what educators could do. As you are testing a child, an adult, an individual, how do you convey through your report those strengths and the strategies or accommodations that may best suit this individual? And again, we're just talking about school-age children.
So to start, whenever I'm talking to anybody about the child, whether it's parent, teacher, another healthcare professional, the child themselves, I'm actively looking for strengths. I'm actively asking, you know, what are this child's strengths? What's great about this child? Rather than just sort of letting them, you know, come up naturally, I'm going to go and look for them. And then I make sure to include a section in the report that is a specific list of this child's strengths. And that includes, there are any cognitive strengths. And Sarah gave such a tremendous you know, list of possible strengths, but, you know, maybe this child has a great ability to hyper-focus and do a deep dive on a topic. Maybe they have really, really strong working memory or a great memory for facts. It includes their academic strengths. You know, are they a tremendous reader? Are they really great at math? But most importantly, it includes their personality strengths, like their compassion or their sense of humor or their grit. I mean, those are the strengths that I really love to get into because those are the ones that are easy to overlook. And so just explicitly putting a list of those strengths in the report. And I always sort of have a secret goal for myself of making the list of strengths longer than the list of weaknesses. And pretty much every time I'm able to do that, if I just sit there and think about the child, it's easy to do that.
And then as a parent, I'm thinking through kind of a parent lens and just as a parent being on both sides of that IEP table, and then also a former special educator, you know, as our children go into middle school, we go into high school, beyond, their task with several different types of teachers, right? And, you know, going through their school day and changing classes and stuff. What advice do you have for parents to continuously kind of express to a teacher, you know, that here are the strengths, and how do you kind of take your parent heart to say, here's my baby and this is who they really are? And kind of in your words, Sarah, they're not just trying to get out of something, but they genuinely need this. So how can we as parents do the right job with our child when we're going changing years to different teachers?
Yeah. So, I mean, the first thing I always remember is that teachers are people too. Right? They are people who are overwhelmed. They are, you know, handling one of the hardest jobs in the world and often balancing that with their own families and life stressors. And they don't have time to go off and read everybody's neuropsych evals and every page of every single IEP. That's just not realistic. What I always did for my own kids was at the beginning of the year, made a brief connection with each teacher through an email. So I wasn't taking up a lot of their time and expecting them to pay a lot of attention to me, but giving them a one-page, very brief cheat sheet, not a lot of words on it. Look, here are the great things about my kid. Here are the things that my kid's struggling with. And here are like the top three ways you can support my kid. And making it very, very clear, if you have any concerns at all, reach out to me however you want, phone call, email, text. I will be very responsive and very collaborative with you. We're on the same team. And just trying to make it easy for the teacher to get to know my kid and to know how to support my kid. I think that's really important.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome.
And just to add to that, something I did, I did the same thing, a cheat sheet that I gave at the beginning of the year. And as my kids got older, then I asked them to give the sheet to the teacher so that, you know, the teacher, and they would help me write the cheat sheet. So, you know, basically shifting the load from me to them so that they knew that this was something that they had communicated to the teacher.
And what a great advocacy skill that's going to then carry with the students beyond, you know, even when they're on a job, whether it's a part-time job during the, you know, whether in school or wherever life will lead them, to be able to advocate and say, here are the top three things that work really well for me. And I'm actually really awesome. And here are my three things of why, and just to be able to advocate. And I think we want that for all of our students, that advocacy piece.
Yeah.
What type of tools or reward systems can be built in to connect with students with autism?
So I think it's maybe less than tools and reward systems and more about how we interact with them, is if we're talking about connection, right? And so one thing I would say is to meet them where they're at. So for example, my son, who is just loves history, particularly military history, which I do not find interesting at all. I just cannot wrap my brain around why that would be interesting to somebody, because we all have different interests, right? But I'm really grateful that I somehow found the patience and the motivation to spend many, many hours letting him talk with me about history. And we would take long walks or bike rides or whatever, and he would go on and on about history, because that really helped us connect. I needed to sort of meet him where he was at. And over time, those conversations led to other conversations. History would be a jumping off point to have other conversations. And I did learn a lot about history. And that was fun. sometimes with some autistic kids, it has to be more about activities than conversation itself. And, you know, sometimes we as parents want to get into conversations with our kids. How was your day? Tell me about your friends. What are you doing this weekend? What's your favorite class? And a lot of adolescents don't want to engage in that sort of conversation, but particularly a lot of autistic adolescents, it won't come naturally to them. That sort of conversation just for conversation's sake is not as intuitive for many of them. And so instead of trying to force that conversation, find activities that are mutually enjoyable and do those activities together, even if they're quiet. I used to do something with my son, and it's so funny, I'm blanking out on what it was right now, but we had one activity we did for a couple of years where it was pretty much silent. We would do something together in absolute silence, and yet it was a deep, deep way of connecting, and I'm appreciative of that. Another thing is to be aware of your expectations of your children in the home, particularly if you're not autistic yourself. So I don't happen to be autistic. So for example, I really like eye contact, and I sort of expect eye contact as sort of part of typical interactions. And my kids taught me actually fairly recently, a year or two, that it's kind of unfair for me to expect them to always make eye contact with me just because I like eye contact. As they said to me, hey, we have to make eye contact out there in the world all day long. And we do it because we know we have to, but we shouldn't have to do it in our own home, right? And so it was just, that was a real learning experience for me about being open and having open dialogue about the autistic preferences, the non-autistic preferences, and how we can sort of bridge that gap. I think Sarah was itching to say something here.
Yeah, I wanted to mention, like, we spend a lot of time in our house literally just sitting together in the living room, reading or on our computers or whatever, and then sharing what we find amusing, because my husband's often reading Twitter or something like that. But, you know, like last night, my son, you know, sends me a text message. He's like, Mom. So one of our favorite podcasts is 99% Invisible, and the podcast host is named Roman Mars. And Oliver sends me this message, Mom, I just realized that Mars is the Roman god of war. But, you know, just sharing these little things. And it's just because we spend time sitting together, each of us doing kind of our own thing, but we're together having that. And Donna, one of the things you were talking about with the eye contact, like something that's such a high priority in our house is that home has to be a safe space.
Yes.
Has to be a safe space for our kids. And so whatever I need to do to make home feel safe for them is my highest priority.
It's so true. And you and I, Sarah, talk about this all the time when people ask us what's like our number one tip for parents, the number one parents thing parents can do, not only to connect with their kids, but to make their kids feel supported, to bring down the emotional level during hard moments, is validation. There is nothing as important as validating your children, particularly your autistic children, because they get inadvertently invalidated over and over and over again throughout their lives. And that does something to a person. So you don't have to validate their perceptions, because you might really disagree with their perception of a situation, but you can always validate their feelings, no matter what they're feeling. You can help them understand, yeah, you're feeling really, really pissed off about that. And I get it. If that happened to me, I'd be really pissed off too. I get it, truly. You know, that kind of validation will never lead you wrong. And so when you're in a rough parenting moment or a good parenting moment, any parenting moment, and you're not sure what to say, always lead with validation. It will never steer you in the wrong direction, and it will always help you connect with your child.
Yes. And then sometimes with my own personal children, when you validate, especially my middle son, he'll say, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just thank you. Yeah. Like, I just needed to be heard. Like, it could be, you know, this huge emotional situation, and he'll just say, oh, thanks, Mom.
Right. I mean, even as adults, notice the next time you're upset about something, notice what you need and what makes you feel better. It's when somebody validates you, right? Mm-hmm. And I've noticed as my kids move through adolescence and then young adulthood, which is a time when it's sometimes harder to keep that strong connection with your children, we were able to keep the strong connection. And I credit that to validation. It keeps them coming back to you mm-hmm. over and over and over again. It keeps them talking to you.
Yeah. I remember, I'm embarrassed to admit, but I did spend a fair amount of my children's early childhood invalidating their experiences, trying to help them see other perspectives, and then inadvertently invalidating their perspective. And I remember learning about validation, being like, oh, that sounds interesting. So I tried it with my younger son. He was upset about something. And I just, you know, validated, yeah, that sounds really frustrating and upsetting. And I would be upset too. And I remember he kind of leaned back in his bed and he looked at me and he said, you really get it? Yeah. And I was just like, and it just stopped his meltdown. It just stopped it. So, you know, it was just so powerful. And I didn't actually agree with what he was upset about, but you know, I did see why he was upset. I definitely understood why he was upset. And he was just so blown away by that. So yeah, you know, it is super powerful.
Yeah. There's a great book called The Power of Validation. If parents want to learn more about this, it's a small book, so it's not overwhelming. And I think the author's name is Karen Hall. And I would highly recommend it because it helps sort out the nuances, for instance, between encouraging a child mm-hmm. and validating a child, because it's easy to get those two things confused, right? Because encouraging is, you can do it, whereas validating is, this is really hard, you know? And you still want to add the encouragement, but you can't skip over the validation. You want it to be, this is really hard, and you can do it.
And what an easy, it doesn't take a lot of time, right? So you can mm-hmm. do it even if you're a professional in that setting. If you're a teacher, you can take that step. And what a terrific resource that you just shared. How do parents highlight strengths, especially when life can be hard and sometimes those bad things outweigh the good?
So I would, one of the things that I think is important is that, you know, your kid has bad moments. But I try to separate the bad moments from who they are as a person, right? So, you know, Donna actually was telling me a story about how one of her kids was being a pill. And then, you know, she came back later and was being really nice. And Donna said, you know, this is the real you. I really appreciate the real you. And I think that's so wonderful. What I would often say for my kids is, you know, I would say, you know, so my younger son has a lot of shame about his behavior during meltdowns and so on. So he feels tremendous shame. And one of the things I talk to him about is the fact that the world is harder for him. It is harder for him. He is dealing with a lot more than I ever have to deal with just because of how he's wired. And so, you know, I really emphasize his grit and his resilience. And, you know, I say, it's harder for you and you're learning. And he'll say things like, I don't want to talk about my past self. And I always say, you know what? Your past self is part of who you are now. And even though you don't think that that person was behaving the way you wish you were, you've overcome that. And that's a big deal. So just trying to help him understand that, you know, I think kids think we're all the same, right? Like, you know, grownups are the same as me. Like they just think we're all the same. And so they don't realize that they are navigating more than I ever had to navigate as a child.
I think that's such a good point, Sarah. And I just want to build on that concept of the real you. I think it's important to help kids learn the difference between their character and their behavior. Mm-hmm. Because you can be a really, really, really good person. And pretty much I think every kid is a really, really, really good person and still behave badly sometimes. And yeah. We all do. I mean, show me a parent who hasn't lost it with his or her kids, right? I mean, we all behave badly sometimes. That doesn't mean we're bad people. That's the difference between character and behavior, and helping them see that is important.
Yeah.
How can we help our students or our children practice social skills?
So
like, how can we kind of help them navigate, I guess, is I'm not really sure I'm framing this the right way, but how can we help them navigate a world that's not wired for them?
It's such a tricky question because traditionally people think, oh, your child has autism, you put them in a social skills group and teach them social skills. But it's so much more complex than that, because there are a lot of kids who are autistic and are camouflaging too much to the point where they're stressing themselves out, making themselves anxious, and they're not developing a sense of self, a sense of who they are, because they're so busy pretending to be somebody else all day long. And so part of the trick with all of, and this is true for all of us and all of our kids, but particularly true for autistic kids, you want to find that balance between putting on that mask when you need to cope with different social situations. Hey, we all do it, right? In theory, I could be doing it right now. Like I could be dealing with a massive migraine right now, but sort of managing it to do this podcast interview, mm-hmm. right? We can all relate to something like that. But also being able to drop the mask and know who you really are as a person, and to have safe places and safe people where you can just completely be yourself, no matter what that looks like, right? So a kid who doesn't flap all day long at school because he's learned flapping makes other kids make fun of me, but comes home and is able to, you know, flap for an hour or pace for an hour to self-regulate and get it out of his system, and trying to find a balance in their lives between, you know, the camouflaging and the not camouflaging, I think helps. If a kid really does want to improve their social skills, mm-hmm. depending on the kid, sometimes a social skills group can be the right fit. But for a lot of these kids who are very verbal and already have good basic social skills and need sort of a higher level of conversational skills, improv classes can actually be quite helpful, because, you know, they've already learned the basics. They don't need somebody to sit there and practice, you know, when somebody says, how are you? You say, fine, and how are you, right? They're past that. But the core tenet of improv is to pay attention to what the other person says, and to say yes and, to build on what the other person is saying. And so I have found that improv classes can actually be really helpful for some types of autistic kids, and frankly, non-autistic kids as well, to get better social skills going.
And I'm just going to build on that. I find that there are some kids who really do want to know what the rules are. Like they really, really, really want to know. And so for those kids, those social skills classes can be super helpful. But I do think that what Donna said is really important. If the kid, you know, is asking for it or frustrated about the fact that, you know, other kids aren't interacting with them, like you want to make sure that they think that the reason you're doing this is not because you think they're broken, but rather to help them navigate the world so they can feel better about being in it. So one thing that does happen is the kids get the message that, you know, if you don't interact like other people, you're a broken person. And that's a hard message. The other thing I'm going to just touch on is that a lot of times those social skills classes are teaching sort of what I call higher level things, like please and thank you and hello and goodbye and you know, just the social conventions. But there's deeper level of social interaction, which has to do with reciprocity, for example. So, you know, for a kid who monologues a lot, right, who just loves telling you about their favorite thing because they know you'll love it as much as they do if you just know about it, they might need to understand that some people really don't want to hear about that. Right. And so helping them understand the back and forth of conversation and to feel good with that back and forth rhythm. For some kids, that rhythm is actually extremely overwhelming. And so, you know, thinking about how you co-regulate with another person, just noticing how what you're doing is landing on them, and that, and understanding that your own behavior can have an impact on how they are feeling. So helping kids understand that is so fundamental and often something that needs to be explicitly taught. So, you know, there are a lot of underlying skills. You know, another one we talk about is joint attention, that if I'm looking at something, it's probably important that you be looking at it too. And the example I'll give is, like, I'm sitting here in my office. If you were with me and I suddenly whipped my head around and looked out the window, you would probably look out that window too, because you would know that something, I thought something was important enough to look out that window. Maybe there's a bear, who knows, you know, like, and so, like, that concept that what one person is attending to might be an important thing for you to be attending to. You know, these are more fundamental skills, that reciprocity, that joint attention. Those things are really important. And I do find a lot of social skills classes actually don't touch on those fundamentals as much. And so, you know, thinking about those kinds of things is also helpful, and understanding that it can be overwhelming. I had a kid on my caseload who, you know, we were working on just a simple motor back and forth. You know, we were doing row, row, row your boat. And it was a, you know, an action like this. He could handle two iterations of that before he got totally overwhelmed and needed to leave and regroup. Right. So, and many years later now, he loves it. He loves taking walks with his parents. He loves, you know, all these things, but it took a long time for him to be able to even tolerate that back and forth.
You know, and I just want to add, again, going back to that idea of validation, as we do all of this, remembering there's no right or wrong way to have a conversation. Mm-hmm. And talking to kids about, you know, the autistic preference and or style and the non-autistic style. And the non-autistic style of conversation is very back and forth. I talk, you talk on the same topic, right? And, you know, 97% of the world prefers that style of conversation, which makes us feel like it's the right way to do it. But a lot of autistic people might prefer, I'm going to info dump on you for a really, really long time. I don't need you to look at me or nod or say anything. I just want you to listen. And then you can info dump on me if you want. And I'm not going to necessarily look at you or nod or say anything, but I'll listen. Right. And that's not wrong. It's just different. And just remembering that, it's, I have to sort of keep pushing myself to remember that there's no right or wrong here.
You know, it's interesting because my younger son does info dump, and he says it's because he's so excited about it that he wants me to know about it too, because he knows I'll be just as excited as him once I know it all. So I think framing the info dump that way is very helpful to me. But the other thing is, you said you don't necessarily have to listen. For him, if I'm not listening and responding, and if I don't remember, heaven help me in the future, he's going to be mad. And he used to do things like grab my face and yank it towards him when I was kind of spacing out during that. So, you know, kids are different about that, and people are different about that. He really wanted me to be in there engaged and remembering about things that I knew nothing about. So I was having to do a lot of learning.
What accommodations have you seen in schools that have worked really well, that are out of the box, you know, that somebody may not typically think of, that are absolutely easy to implement within a school day or within your home?
Yeah. So for school accommodations, you know, we see the same ones over and over again, things like priority seating. I call it strategic seating, and explicitly say that the student should have a big say in where they sit in each class, because in one classroom, they might want to be right near the front of the room for some reason. In another class, they might feel like, nope, by that point of the day, I'm stimming a little bit and I want to be in the back where nobody can see me. They might want to be by the door so they can make a quick exit because they're anxious about getting to their next class on time. And so it's not as simple as put them in the front of the classroom, right? There are a lot that I often recommend that I don't see. So don't call on them unless their hand is raised. Mm-hmm. That can be really helpful for kids who have social anxiety or for kids who can't have a hard time dealing with the unexpected, you know, unexpectedly be called on. If they know the teacher's not going to call on me unless my hand is raised, they can relax and just listen to the lesson and stop worrying about that. Maybe having a private space for lunch, either by themselves or with a friend or two if they want, because the cafeteria might cause so much sensory overwhelm. I mean, I don't know anybody who eats in those cafeterias. I get into sensory overwhelm if I have to walk into one, but that could set them off for their whole afternoon. So instead of making them sit in the cafeteria in the middle of the day, let them sit in a quiet private space for lunch. Same thing for pep rallies or other large assemblies that can cause neuro crash or sensory or social overwhelm. If they want to go, sure, by all means, have at it. But if they find that that's overwhelming, let them just go to the media center and read a book during large assemblies. Same thing for field trips. Field trips not only takes a kid out of their regular routine and makes them miss other classes, which can be stressful for some kids, but there are sensory demands and a lot of social demands on field trips, and they might prefer to just skip it. Definitely supporting them more during group projects, or sometimes giving them the option to do a solo project in lieu of a group project if that's going to work better for them. As they get older, and particularly in college, and kids start getting graded on class participation, for some kids, that's not really fair to grade them on class participation, and giving them another option to show that they're really engaging with the material, but not necessarily requiring them to talk in front of class. In front of the whole class. And other things at college, definitely a private dorm room can be helpful, but also the placement of the dorm room. So in a quiet dorm, if there is one, but if there isn't one, then not right across from the elevator or the community room where there's noise at all hours of the day and night, and letting them move into the dorm early, a few days, you know, before everybody else, when the RAs and the band and everybody moves in and it's still quiet and they can adjust to their surroundings before it gets really chaotic. So those are some things that come to mind.
Sarah, do you have anything to add?
I loved what Donna said about the seating and also the importance of letting kids, you know, take a break. She said that, you know, don't call on them unless their hand is raised, but something, and I do see this one. So these things that Donna was talking about, I don't often see, but one that I really find a lot of kids do find helpful is the teacher says ahead of time, I'm gonna ask you a question about whatever, like before the class starts. So they have time to compose their answer. And then the teacher says, I will call on you about this. And so that way the child has time to compose the answer. Another one is giving the kid time to process. Mm-hmm. So a lot of autistic people need time to compose their thoughts. That's not because, you know, they don't know what to say. It's literally because they're sorting through so many different options. And so giving them time to sort through the options and come up with an answer, this can be very hard in a classroom setting, especially when the kid next to him is going, ooh, 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 you know, or whatever. But giving them time to process and then get it out is really important and also very hard. But those are two things that I, you know, those are often in IEPs or whatever, but it's just, they're so critical.
We talked about tips for parents briefly. You mentioned it. And one of your first tips was validation. Do you have any other tips for parents that they could take away from our conversation today?
So one of them that I would just, I think we all know this, but unconditional love and true acceptance. So kids feel that so deeply, and there is nothing more powerful than that feeling that my parent gets me, they value me as I am, and it's a huge deal, and it's not an easy journey, I will say. As a parent, I definitely shift in and out of that. I hate it when I'm not in the acceptance mode, but it is such a powerful, powerful feeling to know that your parent really, really gets you and loves you exactly as you are. Also remembering that your kids are doing the best they can, right? So don't assume they're being oppositional just to be little jerks or something. They really may not understand what you want them to do or why it's important. So, you know, just assume that they're doing the best they can. And, you know, we talked about the importance of home being a safe place. That's part of that unconditional love and acceptance. And I think that's just so, so important. And, you know, a sidebar to that is your goal is not to make them look non-autistic. Your goal here is for them to figure out how they can be and honor themselves, right, in a world that's not built for them, but make sure that they have places where they can be who they are without having to camouflage and without having to make excuses. You know, spending time by yourself is something a lot of kids really need. Autistic kids need a lot of time to themselves, some of them, not all of them. And so making sure you don't judge that. I used to judge that in my older son. I used to be like, no, you need to go out and be with friends. And he was just like, Mom, I really, really just need to hibernate for a while. And just honoring that and not making him feel bad because he needed that. That was really important. So those are a few I can think of.
And what would you say your three tips would be for professionals?
Oh, so I'll take this one. One would be to consider your own emotions around autism. So many professionals are intimidated by autism. So many of us did not get enough training or got minimal training about this unbelievably complex entity. And a lot of people, a lot of professionals I've met just communicate to me, I'm embarrassed. I feel like I should understand autism, but I really don't. And it's a real problem. And then other professionals think of autism as sort of categorically bad and avoid it. So just consider your own feelings. And if you feel intimidated or unprepared or like you don't know enough about autism, know that you're not alone. That's actually really common. And then there's research. Sarah's and mine clinical experience. And there's actual research now showing that we're not getting enough training about autism. Next, I would say to remember that many autistic kids camouflage at school, but pay a huge price for it in the rest of their day. And so when you have a kid who's doing well in the classroom, whether you're a teacher or a professional working with that kid, and then the parents tell you, but seriously, he or she is losing it after school every single day and it's a disaster, believe that parent. That is not a parenting problem. That is that the child was camouflaging all day and they can't sustain it. And that means that the adjustments need to be made at school. Even if there are no overt academic or behavioral problems at school, the emotional cost to the student is just too high to sustain it. So just remembering that we're dealing with a whole person here, not just the school day. And finally, I would just really encourage all professionals, educators and healthcare professionals, to update their knowledge about autism. Our understanding of autism has expanded dramatically over the past decade, particularly in regards to autistics who camouflage so well that they can sort of pass as non-autistic, which, you know, this population has been a particular interest for me and Sarah. And so it's essential for people to update their knowledge about this group of people.
As we wind down, is there anything that I didn't know enough that I should have asked?
Oh, wow, you asked so many great questions, Wendy. I mean, I feel like we could talk all day about this.
We sure could. Absolutely. Absolutely. We sure could. So my final question to you both is, if you had a billboard with one saying, what would it be and why?
Oh my goodness. I mean, I'll say something that feels cliche at this point, but it's what popped into my mind. If you've met one autistic person, you've met one autistic person. And just like non-autistic people, each one is completely unique, and get to know that person, both their challenges and their strengths.
And I think mine would be, I hope that difference can inspire curiosity instead of judgment.
Hmm. Oof. Excellent. Excellent. Well, this was quite a real and raw conversation that I know is going to be impactful for folks that are listening. And this stems from your book, Is This Autism? A Guide for Clinicians and Everyone Else. Can you let us know when it's coming out, how folks can find you, and all the good stuff so they can get more of both of you?
So on Donna's website, she has a blog post called, I Wrote a Book. and
no guessing there.
That's right. And it's got a picture of our cover, which actually has a lovely painting on it by an autistic artist called My Amazing Team. The reason we wanted that partly is it's an awesome painting, but we had an amazing team helping us with this book. Amazing team, clinicians, autistic people, friends, colleagues. I can't even, so many people helped us with this book. It is due to be released on June 5th. And we actually just got an email with the production schedule yesterday. So it's really getting real. And you can pre-order it on Amazon. I don't know if you can pre-order it on Barnes & Noble, but I have seen it on Barnes & Noble. It is there. And so there you go. That's what I can tell you.
I hope many people are pre-ordering it. There's going to be terrific insight, especially if you loved this conversation. It's going to go way deeper and supportive of autistic individuals. And so I, again, am very thankful and grateful for your time and having this poignant conversation today.
Thank you for having us, Wendy. It was really a pleasure.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You bet.
Thank you again for strategizing with us and spending your precious time listening. If you've loved what you've heard, give us a like and a follow at Learning Essentials. Looking for free tips? Head over to learningessentialsedu.com and you can download free tips to prepare for an IEP meeting, plus bonus questions to ask. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. If you need more special education support, visit Learning Essentials, where we provide an individualized and systematic approach to supporting students with various learning needs and differences through academic coaching, educational therapy, and BrainCamp, our executive function support model. If you are a parent, I've got you covered. Head on over to learningessentialsedu.com and I can walk you through that IEP journey. Mm-hmm.